Lord, thank you for this time together. Thank you for the just privilege of interacting with people who are so thoughtful and have such a concern for moral rightness before you regarding economic decisions and in our own lives, and concern for the poor and how to help the needs of the world's poor. And now we come to think about government, Lord, which you've given as a gift to us, that we might be protected from anarchy and evil, but also a government which can be tyrannical and corrupt and detrimental to human well-being. We ask that you'd give us wisdom from your word about these things as well. In Jesus' name, amen. If a nation is going to move from poverty to prosperity, we talked this morning about how a free market system is necessary. That's the economic system. It has to have rule of law. It has to have a fair court system. It has to have private ownership of property, documented property rights, stable currency, low taxes. Those things constitute a free market. But a free market is not enough. And if people come away saying, Grudem and Asmus have their solution to poverty is a free market, they've misunderstood us completely. Part of it is a free market, but another part, a big part, is the government in the country. And another part is cultural values. So those are these two sessions. The Bible has immense wisdom about government, and we need to pay attention to it. Here's a summary of what Barry and I want to say this session. If a country is going to move from poverty toward prosperity, its leaders must use governmental power for the benefit of the people as a whole rather than for themselves. Using government power for the people rather than themselves. That's the heat. That's the heart of it. That's the key to it. I think that's anchored in Romans 13:4, where Paul says, when he talks about what government is in God's purpose, says the civil authority is God's servant for your good. God's servant for your good. I shared that verse with the Prime Minister of Albania, sat across the table from him, had an ESV study Bible to give him, and asked him if I could talk to him about what the Bible said about him. First I said, can I show you where the Bible talks about Albania? Yes, he's quite stern, but he's fluent in English. He's a cardiologist by training. And so I turned to Romans 15, where it says Paul has preached the gospel from Jerusalem around as far as Illyricum. And I said, Illyricum, if you look in the note in this ESV study Bible, it says Illyricum is the territory of the Roman Empire that is current Albania and parts of what was formerly Yugoslavia. And he read that and he said, this is true. And I'm thinking, I know it's true, I wrote that note. Mr. Prime Minister, could I show you one other thing that I think the Bible says about you? Yes. I turn back to Romans 13:4, just a couple pages back. Here it says, the official is God's servant for your good. I think this means, Mr. Prime Minister, that God has put you in leadership in Albania as his servant to do good for the people of Albania. See, that's what Paul said about the Roman Empire and the Roman officials in Romans 13. God's servant for your good. And it seemed to me and to Barry that he was touched by that. I don't know what his own spiritual situation was. He's Muslim by background and tradition. But it was an opportunity to apply Romans 13:4. I think that gives us the key to understanding what officials in governments should do. They should serve for the good of the people. And if you look at every single red and dark red country on this map has come there historically, or currently finds itself in a situation where the leaders serve for the benefit of the leaders and their friends. They put their hands in the national treasury and they take. just what Samuel predicted a king would do. He will take, he will take, he will take, he will take. And they're serving for themselves, not for the people. So that's the heart of what we want to say today, that government should serve for the benefit of the people rather than themselves. It's what Abraham Lincoln used in this memorable phrase that characterized the American government. Government of the people, by the people, and for the people, not just for the rulers. Sadly, there are examples around the world where the opposite is true. In the course of our preparation for writing this book, Barry and I, do you have Marantz's book? African Friends and Money Matters. This was by far the saddest book that we ever read in months and years of research on our study. David Marantz says he has over 25 years' experience living in various sub-Saharan African countries. I don't know much about his background. It doesn't tell a lot. Anthropologist, ethnologist. And he very dispassionately lays out differences between cultural values toward money and monetary issues that are held by common people in sub-Saharan Africa and in Western countries. And he just lays out about 90 of them. Just says, well, Africans view it this way, Westerners view it this way. And it's amazing how many of those 90 are hindrances to economic productivity. I'm going to read you about government here. Marantz says, a major function of government, this is in many African countries, is to provide money and other resources to those members of society who are in power, who have a close relationship to those who are in power. The unofficial role of government, this unofficial role of government is widely observed in Africa. Many of the conflicts, the wars, and the leaders clinging to power are a direct result of the practice. The pressure is immense from above, that is higher officials, and from below, lower officials, and friends and neighbors and family. The pressure is immense from above and below on individuals in government and business, to use their positions for the direct benefit of themselves and family members. Leaders in society, religious leaders, political leaders, business leaders, are expected to be people who distribute resources and in other ways provide for their followers when they have needs. David Landis, economic historian from Harvard, says, in Africa, the richest people are heads of state and their ministers. It isn't just Africa. In China, the emperor took all and ruled over all for centuries. In India, the Mughal princes took what they wanted. And powerful kings in Britain and France did the same. It's a common pattern, a violation of property rights, but it's using government for the benefit of the rulers. Contrast the amazing blessing of the early history of the United States. Washington, first president. John Adams, second president. Thomas Jefferson. James Monroe, John Quincy Adams, first five presidents. I don't know much about subsequent history. I can't name them all. Not one of them was someone committed to using government for his own good and taking and taking. They were committed to serving for the benefit of the people. What a blessing in the history of our country. So now, is there anything, we're going to get cultural values later, but what about structural things that can protect governments against people using their power to take and to be corrupt? We have ...17 structural elements and then another 19 or 20 freedoms to protect. I can't go through all of them, but I'm going to give you an idea of some of them. Number one is rule of law. That means all people are accountable equally to the laws, even the king. This is the most basic guarantee that leaders will use their power for the benefit of the people as a whole. And it includes the idea that the law also has a moral authority. The outstanding narrative example to prove this in the Bible is the story in 2 Samuel 11 of David and Bathsheba. David was the most powerful man in the country, but he sinned in committing adultery and then having Bathsheba's husband put to death. And Nathan the prophet came to him and said, "You are the man." In other words, David, you may be the king, but you are not above God's law. God's law is over you, and you are guilty. So So the rule of law, everybody must be subject to the law. And if you have a poor country, inevitably you will have the president or the king and his friends violating the law with impunity and not being subject to penalties. That's number one. Number two, look, I tell you what, I wasn't sure whether I'm going to say this or not, but I'm concerned whether whatever political affiliation you have, I think if you're a Democrat or a Republican, I think we should all be concerned about a recent pattern in the United States of government officials not being subject to the laws and not upholding the laws with regard to the legal provisions connected to Obamacare and many of the provisions the government refuses to enforce with regard to the laws about immigration, with regard to the laws about recess appointments, and with regard to the conduct of the IRS. They're very troubling because they're a pattern of government using its power not to enforce the law equally on everybody, but to have a disregard for laws, and that's a concern to me. All right, number two, that was an aside. A fair court system. The courts must show no favoritism or bias, but enforce justice impartially. Barry mentioned microloans last night. Microloans are a helpful thing. They help people gain some prosperity in a poor country. But, oh, I need an example here. What's your name? Joseph. If Joseph gets a microloan and has a little, maybe you're a tailor and you sew clothes and you get a microloan, you buy a sewing machine, you start to grow your business. And then you have somebody else work for you and you start to grow your business. And then the government comes and takes it all away. Or bribes an official to shut down your factory. What good is it if the government is corrupt? If the laws are not enforced equally, then you take the person to court, and the judge is the cousin of the people who defrauded you. A fair court system is really important. Deuteronomy 16. This was an emphasis in the laws that God gave to Israel. In Deuteronomy 16, verses 18 to 20, you shall appoint judges and officers in all your towns that the Lord your God is giving you. They shall judge the people with righteous judgment. You shall not pervert justice. You shall not show partiality, and you shall not accept a bribe. For a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and subverts the cause of the righteous. Justice, and only justice, you shall follow. Number three, related to this, so rule of law, fair court system, absence of bribery and corruption in government offices. Deuteronomy 16 again, you shall not accept a bribe. Many other passages in Scripture that we talk about in our book. Certainly government officials should be reasonably compensated for their services, but laws should prevent them from becoming wealthy through gifts or promises. Bribery and corruption have enormously hindered economic development in Eastern Europe, pre-British India, and many African societies. And many communist countries generally. David Landis, economic historian, corruption continually hindered economic development in Eastern Europe. And in communist countries, the former Soviet Union, North Korea, Cuba, there is immense influence of government officials and bribery is so common. Now, here's something we can be thankful for in the United States. If government officials are found to be guilty of bribery, they're punished. Just within this past month, Bob McDonnell in governor of Virginia? McDonald, and I think he's probably a born-again believer, and just from little things I've read, and he's a Republican, and I think he had some good policies, but he accepted Rolex watch, some fancy vacations, $10,000 or more, a businessman paid for his daughter's wedding reception, $10,000 or $20,000, and some other fancy gifts. And he was convicted, and he's going to go to prison. I'm sad for him, but I'm glad that I live in a country that punishes corruption. Does that make sense? We still have a country that believes if you get caught using your government office for personal enrichment, you'll be punished, and you'll be out of office. And it happens again and again. Why does corruption persist in poor countries? Paul Collier, economist, development economist. Why is bad government so persistent in some environments? One evident reason is not everyone loses from it. The leaders of the poorest countries in the world are themselves among the global super rich. They like the things the way they are. Gabon is in West Africa. Abysmal poverty among the people. I saw a newspaper article where the president had finally died after 20 or 30 years in office. He had $4 or $5 billion in Swiss bank accounts while the people suffered, because Gabon has oil, but he was taking the money. Among the world's super rich are the leaders of poor countries in many cases. So number three, absence of bribery and corruption. Number four, four and five together. Four is going to be adequate power of government to maintain stability, but five is going to be limited power of government. So I want to say it has to have enough power, but then it has to have limited power. Governments must have enough power to punish crime. The Bible recognizes the evil results that come when there's no effective government and anarchy prevails. Judges 17 to 21, though there was no king in Israel, and everyone did what was right in his own eyes, an immense crime and evil and sin. Help me now. Where's Somalia? Is this Somalia? Anybody want to set up a business in Somalia? Got $1 million to invest? Why don't you, a poor country, why don't you want to invest in Somalia? It's not just the corrupt. It's completely, there's anarchy. There's no effective government. And so it's pirates that keep capturing ships and just marauding bands that can take what they want. Where there's no government, a government doesn't have enough power to control things, again, the economy won't grow. Adequate power of government. But then number five, limited power of government. The power of government must be limited enough so it doesn't take too much freedom from the people. And so excessive power taken by government keeps economies from growing. China had many early inventions, but the emperors kept it for their own enjoyment, and the people remained in abject poverty. Russia, all-powerful czars, controlled all of life for centuries. In many African nations, tribal chiefs exercised nearly unlimited rule. Too much power, and so the limitations must be placed on government to prevent them from abusing their excessive power. Again, part of the reason for the immense prosperity of the United States is our founding fathers set up a government whereby the government would have enough power to restrain crime and govern the nation, but there were abundant checks on the power and restrictions on the power of government. So we have in the United States constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech. Government can't suppress you when you criticize them. Freedom of the press, same. Freedom of religion, immensely important, basic necessity. Freedom of assembly, freedom to petition the government, right to bear arms, term limits for office. See, these immense wealthy people in these corrupt countries have office for life, Mugabe in Zimbabwe, for instance. Term limits on the office of president and regular election of members of Congress. The reason I think it was helpful that I brought up the disregard for the law that I've seen in a pattern recently in recent years in the present situation in the United States is that our founding fathers anticipated that things like that would happen, and they built into the Constitution a system whereby the country would correct itself if it started to go astray. And what we're seeing is that the House of Representatives has to be elected every 2 years, frequent accountability to people, and the Senate has to be elected every 6 years. And so frequent accountability by regular elections means that if people think the government is going astray or spending too much, they can vote the officers out and get new people. So the question is this protection going to function? And I think it is, at least to some extent, function. And then not only limited power of government, but separation of powers in government. Let me give you an example. In a number of countries in Latin America, if you take over the army, you rule the nation, because the army is also the local police. But if you take over the army in the United States, would you rule Louisville? No, because our military, our national military, is prevented by law from doing internal police power within the United States. So the police force in Louisville is subject to the mayor of Louisville. And the governor of Kentucky can't order the police force in Louisville around. And so with other cities in Kentucky, local police forces can't be taken over by a central government. That's a protection against excessive power of government. That's a separation of powers. Barry talked about judicial, legislative, executive branches, separation of powers, and then between the federal government and the states. And this, I think that the states, many of them, are pushing back against the excessive growth of power of the federal government and beginning to correct overreach on the part of the government because there's a separation of powers. We talk about how the Bible supports a division of powers and governments. Well, that was about six factors of the 17. You get the idea. I mean, there are some others like protecting against crime, protecting against violation of contracts, protecting against the violation of patents and copyrights, protection against invasion, various laws. But those examples should be sufficient to say if an economy is going to grow in a nation, the government needs to be able to have accountability so it serves for the good of the people. And there are structural factors that can be built into a government that will help to do that. I recently heard at a dinner in Phoenix, Charles Krauthammer, commentator, speaking at this dinner, and he said a couple of things. He was quite optimistic about the future of the United States. I don't know where he got this quotation. He said, and he's very nominal Jewish by religion. I don't think he believes much about God. But anyway, he quoted some British politician saying, God always seems to look out for children, drunkards, and the United States of America. And he gave a lot of historical examples. So I was glad for that. I don't have a verse. but I'm hopeful. And Margaret and I had opportunity to talk privately with some Christians who are working for reform of government in a very significant unfree country of the world today. And one thing they said to us in private conversation: when we change the government of our country, they didn't say if, they say when. When we change the government of our country, we want to set it up to be like the government of the United States was set up to function. It's amazing. And then in that same speech, Charles Krauthammer said, one of his examples of God caring for the United States, he said, for some reason, in these colonies, these remote colonies in the New World, there were assembled in the 1770s the greatest collection of political geniuses ever to be in one place at one time in the history of the world. So we have protections in our government that are valuable and that God has given to us. We need to treasure and safeguard, because governments that serve for the good of the people are necessary to move from poverty to prosperity and then to maintain increasing prosperity. Okay, Barry.
I hate it when Wayne cries.
I do too. I didn't plan it, Barry, but just, you know what? I love this country. And I feel it deeply. And I'm concerned for it. But I'm hopeful. I'm going to cry again. I'll be quiet.
I'm going to cry right now. Okay, wait, see, this is what happens. I do kind of plan what I want to do, and then it just takes a detour. So just with your crying about America, I'm going to shed a tear for America, and here's how I'm going to do it, because I'm a country boy from eastern Colorado, and I, too, My grandparents came from Russia, came to Ellis Island. They ended up in Colorado as sugar beet farmers, et cetera. And so you heard me tell a little of that story yesterday. I had the wonderful experience of helping rededicate the Statue of Liberty in 1986. And I did a tribute to a freedom, so I'm going to give you some more tears, and then we'll get on, and I'll honestly try to get on the subject matter now that Wayne's got me off. This goes this way. Ladies and gentlemen, my name is the United States of America. I was born on July 4th, 1776, conceived in freedom and liberty, and that freedom has brought millions to my shores to cast their economic plight with me, but that freedom has not been cheap. A million of my sons were killed in the battlefields in Europe, Asia, even on the home front. Countless families have cried in anguish as they've heard of the loss of a father, a son, a husband, a brother, and now even a sister. But thank God those lives stood for something. I am big. From the Atlantic to the Pacific to the northern reaches of Alaska, I have 3.5 million square miles just teeming with economic opportunity and excitement. I have forests in Oregon, wheat fields in Kansas, oil in Texas, coal in West Virginia. I am the Empire State Building in New York City, the Sears Tower, Ellis Tower in Chicago, and Disneyland in Southern California. I have almost 2.5 million farms that are unequal in productivity on any place on the face of this earth. But if you think my story is just about fertile soil and beautiful cities, no, think again. My story is mainly about people. From day one, I've accepted legal immigrants from every country in the world as constitutional equals. I'm a nation of builders, creators, dreamers, doers, inventors, entrepreneurs, engineers, and it goes on and on. But more than a country that just being a country that just works hard, and I do, I'm also a country that loves to play. I love high school sports, college sports, professional sports. The Final Four in college basketball is an institution. The Super Bowl in professional football is almost a national holiday. But more than a nation that just works and plays, I'm a nation that prays. I'm a nation that has almost 300,000 churches where people gather and worship the God who is there because He is not silent. I'm also a country that has gone out to defend and not to conquer, that goes out to protect and not to possess. When I see a defeated enemy, I bind its wounds, I feed its people, I give it billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars to restore itself to a place of honor among the nations of the world. A character, a country's character, after all, is determined by the sum of its splendid deeds. I've abolished slavery. I've helped countless people out of poverty. I've instituted more humanitarian programs for health and medicine than all the rest of the countries of the world combined. Now, if you compare that record with the actual histories of both ancient and contemporary society, America might not be the best conceivable society, but it just might be one of the best societies that has ever existed on the planet. Perfect? No way. Slavery, indeed. Paid a horrific price. 650,000 men were killed in that Civil War. Imagine the sadness of Abraham Lincoln as he makes his way up to the Gettysburg battlefield where 50,000 men fell in 3 days. And over the course of that war, we lost 650,000 men, which is about the equivalent of 200 9/11s back to back. 200 back. So Lincoln begins his Gettysburg address and ends it this way: "We highly resolve that these dead shall not have died in vain, that this nation under God shall experience a new birth of freedom, and that this government of the people, by the people, and for the people shall not perish from the earth." Lincoln was done. It only took him 3 minutes to deliver the Gettysburg Address. It's only 10 sentences long. The battlefield was totally quiet. You could have heard a whisper. Man raised his hand. Mr. President, I have a question for you. Can a nation of the people, by the people, and for the people survive? And Abraham Lincoln answered, I don't know how history is going to speak on America, but I do know that Americans were born to be free. So that's my tearful remarks. I don't give those very often anymore because it's just so out of keeping. This is an evil country. We stole all the land from other indigenous groups, and there's hardly a moral peace in our backbone. That's how many people see it. I see it just the opposite, and so no wonder Wayne and I get along very well. We both can sit on an airplane and tell each other stories and cry together. So it's always such a joy to cry with Wayne, and thanks for letting me present that to you. Now, I got to tell you that the interesting thing about looking at the world on poverty, and certainly as far as their economic systems, we could say this, not everybody agrees with a pretty strong American presumption that life is better than death, that education is better than illiteracy, that freedom is better than slavery, that prosperity is better than poverty. Not everybody agrees on that. The Amazon River people only live to be age 20 to 25, and their sporting contests, the winners get to jump off the cliff to their deaths. So in that sense, death is better than life. Eastern Mexico, those Indian tribes, again, sports contests where the winners are willing to kill themselves because they are the winners. Again, death is better than life. A number of tribes in Papua New Guinea definitely view that death is better than life. So the fact that we all say life is better than death is not held by everybody. So it's an interesting world, isn't it? So sometimes you can't even get an agreement on something that it seems like would be fairly easy propositions. Life is better than death. Education is better than illiteracy. Health is better than sickness. Prosperity is better than poverty. No, not necessarily. But and so maybe it's because there has been quite a lot of confusion in the world from the beginning of time until not long ago that so many different things are tried. Hunting and gathering, subsistence farming, tribalism, slavery, feudalism, colonialism, mercantilism, and so on. Socialism, communism, they've tried, they don't work. And so it's why that Wayne and I say there's only one system that really does work to pull people out of poverty, and that is the free market system. And the reason why the free market system is so wonderful, because it's such a fabulous communicator of information, and that's what people need to make a decision. What's the latest information? And the market system seems to have an ability to bring the diverse thinking, the thoughts together, and oftentimes reflect it in a price. Now, it was Adam Smith that wrote the book, The Wealth of Nations. The Wealth of Nations, even today, is probably one of the most powerful books that's ever been written. Adam Smith was a Scottish economist, one of the very first economists, known as the first economist, and Adam Smith lays it out fairly clear. And so we, as we're talking to leaders and others in poor countries, can say some of the very, very same things that are not a dime's worth of difference between that and what Adam Smith said. He said, look, we got to figure out how to do division of labor. The problem with subsistence farming is everybody is trying to do it all themselves. And as we heard so beautifully today in some other speeches, how lucky we are that the thing about a free market economy is you've got everybody working for you. Instead, if you and I are subsistence farmers, we're on the farm, we got to plant the grain, we've got to harvest the grain, we've got to cook the grain, blah, blah, blah. We have to do every single step. We all allow the whole world to work for us. And so even in the invention of a pencil, it's only 5 cents, but a million people have made an effort to make that pencil beautiful. Now, and when people begin to understand then that, no, division of labor, let each of us do what we do best. And that is such a comfortable thought. Does that mean that if a whole bunch of you want to be writers of poems? Well, if that's your bag, indeed, write poems. That's a harder one to make a living, Wayne said, with his son being an artist. But notice he didn't stay. He shifted, so maybe you won't continue to write poems all your life. But let everybody begin to do what they do best. So that's what Adam Smith says, division of labor and specialization. Smith says, and then keep doing it. Keep doing it because you get good at it. Practice, 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 and you get good. So even Malcolm Gladwell would write a book called The Outliers, where he will tell us, you know what, if a hockey player plays about 10,000 hours of hockey, gets pretty darn good at it, he might even be able to make a living doing hockey. If that pianist at Carnegie Hall, the difference between that pianist at Carnegie Hall and someone that teaches piano at a local high school is that person probably has put in 10,000 hours of practice time. So the beautiful thing about economics is the more you practice and the more you do it and the more you specialize, the better you get. Now think about that. When people begin to do that, that's adding more to the GDP. They just have more talent. I mean, the person that's at Carnegie Hall is worth more, adds more to the economy than does necessarily the piano teacher in some high school. And I sure don't want to put down any piano teachers in high school because it's a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. But anyway, practice, 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 do, specialize, specialize, specialize. And then Adam Smith said, trade. Oh no, don't cut off trade. The bigger the pond, the bigger fish you're going to catch. And the bigger the pond, the more free trade. And so Adam Smith built that in our, talking about comparative advantage and specialization and free trade. A free trade is like a perpetual motion machine. And just make just a tiny little correction of what Wayne either said yesterday or Wayne said today. And this is just a tiny correction. But the interesting thing about trade is you don't even have to produce anything and you can increase world wealth. Mm. See, and the reason is, let's say we shut the doors now and everybody, and so we're going to take just 3 minutes to trade some things, a pencil for a candy bar, this for that, and we're just going to trade. Just take your time, but make sure it's voluntary exchange. No, if I'm going to give you my yellow pencil, yeah, I really do want that candy bar. So do you really, really want to give up that yellow candy bar for this yellow pencil, et cetera, et cetera. So we'd all make trades. But at the end of the hour, guess what? This class is richer. We're more wealthy because we've had voluntary exchange and trade, and for something that we like more than what we traded away. So we didn't produce anything in this class this hour. We haven't produced anything, but we trade. That's what's so magic. When I say that trade is a perpetual motion machine, this is one example. You don't even have to produce anything, and you make people wealthier. Now, difference between talking about wealth production and income. I got it. But the point is, trade is one of the greatest ways to increase wealth. So when the Chinese were at their best, say the year 1000 to the year 1500 AD, when the Chinese were kind of at their best, now gunpowder, yes, they invented it. Printing press, yes, they invented it. And we can name about 50 things. I mean, China was the economy from a year, say, 1000 to 1500. But guess what? One of the dynasties wakes up and says, no more trade. One of the dynasties says, we're not going to do that anymore. One of the even says, we're going to make 2-masted ships illegal. So you can't even get out on the ocean and go anywhere. So, bam, governments always do that. Governments Well, anyway, that's another story. Okay, so they break the back of the tree, and so now China goes into a long slide. I mean, oh, what a pitiful country. 5,000 years of history of very, very bright people, and they go into an economic slide, and they stayed in an economic slide until about the year 1977-78. Mao Zedong has died. Deng Xiaoping takes over. Now, this is no great plea for Mao Zedong. Deng Xiaoping. I don't like him either. He was the guy at Tiananmen Square that killed all those college kids and so on. I mean, Deng Xiaoping believes in freedom of speech, just not freedom after the speech. And so that's how he's treated. And China has always been a place they don't do hardly any counting of heads. They just chop off heads. So this is no big thing for the Chinese. But Deng Xiaoping said that the abolition of private ownership is not working. No kidding, Lone Ranger. So as Deng Xiaoping worked under Mao Zedong, abolition of private ownership, private property, is not working. Back to John Locke's comment, and I mentioned it this morning, private property is the bulwark of freedom. So now, what does Deng Xiaoping do? He begins to give 30-year leases on the land. That's not ownership per se, but that's as close as we're going to get to ownership for a while when we're talking about China. So all of a sudden, now in China, you can kind of move where you want, live with you want, get in some businesses you want, and do just exactly what Adam Smith was calling for: division of labor, specialization, and trade. And he begins to allow that at China, and China now begins to experience an economic liftoff. I'm going to give you the end of the story, because you're interested in the end of the story. I got to tell you that an economic system built on manufacturing export, does work very well for a while. Japan, manufacture export, works well. In the initial stages of economic growth and the bottom levels, perfect. So there's nothing wrong with that. I'll only tell you that a system that is going to just manufacture and trade is going to run out. They're going to hit a wall. Japan hit its wall in 1990. Everyone is predicting the world for Japan in 1990. Everybody. Oh, the future of the world is going to be Japan. Who knew that they would run into a wall in 1999, and they've been up against that wall for the last 25 years. They really are second gas. That's just a total surprise, because they were the second largest and biggest and most powerful economy in the world. And when Japan hit the wall in 1990, China, with this manufacture and trade idea, is going to be doing some of the same things. And then China has a whole bunch of ancillary problems. They're even worse than Japan. One is they've had one baby policy per family, so they've killed all those baby girls. So we have 100 million men that will never have wives, because there aren't enough women to go around, etc., etc. So when you start messing with God that way, in that demographic kind of a way, you are asking for trouble. So at the very least here, it looks like China literally will become old before it becomes rich. And it becomes old because you have to totally watch how many people you've got under the age of 15 and how many people you've got over the age of 65, and that's called the dependency ratio. And when the dependency ratio goes to 50% of your economy, or 60 or 80 or 90%, you are really starting to have some serious problems, and that will be China. They're looking right down that barrel. So they've messed with the demographics. They will pay an enormous price. Second of all, Wayne made it clear today that printing money doesn't create wealth. Money is just a medium of exchange. But China felt, you know, you can create wealth by printing money. They've done it. And I tell you, China has got a problem on its hands. First of all, its property values are inflated tremendously. Like the highest property values maybe in the world, in any industrial country, is London. And it is property value something like 15 to 1 on income. In China today, it's 35 or 40 to 1 on income. So they've got a property value explosion that's going to happen, and I'm telling you, the whole world's going to hear it when it pops. So that's not a signal. That's a signal? Wayne, I gave you 40 minutes. No, I'm teasing.
A minute to conclude? A
minute to go. Well, how am I going to get through all these notes?
I've been wondering that.
Wayne has watched me do this in 10 or 15 countries. He watches me fumble along like this. But our favorite part is right now, so I'm done. Okay. Wayne, come up. And we're going to do Q&A, and that's more fun anyway. But watch this. Wayne always lets me try to answer the question first. And I say, why? Wayne, why do you let me go first? And he says, well, a couple of reasons. One is you're really a fun answering of questions, but you always answer a question that was not asked. So you answer the question that you want to answer, then I'll answer the question, and they get two for the price of one. So here we go.
Barry, I have to say, I've watched you do this many times, and I've enjoyed it every time. And it's always a surprise. But it's very fun.
Oh, you're so... I laid in bed. I was just ready to go to sleep, and Wayne calls me on the phone. And I thought, he's going to call me and say, Barry, 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 stay on the subject. I was just thinking of you when that phone went off. And instead, Wayne calls and said, hey, I think it went pretty well tonight. So we're ready for some questions. Of course, I get the first shot at it.
Yeah, all right.
Because I'll answer what I want to answer.
You had said that one of the problems is that super rich in the really poorest countries, the super rich are the leaders, and the rest of everyone else is in poverty. So one of the things that needs to happen is for those people to either relinquish their power or, you know, just get them out. How exactly do you go about doing that without war and upset?
Okay. How do you get the rich, super rich, corrupt rulers out of power? We don't. The country has to do it itself.
But I mean, a lot of them don't want to be there under them anyway, so.
I know. Yeah. There are things that individuals can do in the United States, and there are things that our government can do. If our government sees a brewing movement to change the government, it can give some kinds of encouragement and support. It can even say publicly, you know, we think the government of such and such a country is corrupt, and we want to say publicly so the world hears, if the freedom movement in this country succeeds, we will recognize you immediately and give you diplomatic assistance and aid. I mean, there's encouragement. And you know, we used to have something called Voice of America that would promote over the airwaves in unfree countries the idea of accountable government and democracy. I think we've pulled back from that because of what Barry called it, the embarrassment of the United States. That's endemic in our academic culture, but we need to restore a value of patriotism and pride in what we've done. So, how do we change it? We can't. So if we're thinking, I'm going to fix that, no, you're not. That's paternalistic. Okay? Does that help?
Yeah.
Okay.
For Barry.
I can't see your name.
Chelsea. For Barry, you mentioned that you were not ashamed of the story between the Indians and the colonials, which is interesting. I am actually colonial and Indian, so I can, sometimes I have these disputes with myself, like, who was fair, who wasn't, and finally, I just came to the conclusion that the Indians weren't living a godly life, and I think God protected the colonials, and so how do you feel, though? Because sometimes, my mother will say, well, I just don't believe with that, and I'm on the Indian side, you know, for no reason. Yeah. Even if her not being Indian, she still wants to resonate with
you. You know, my wife is the same way. She was a history major and loves to study Indians and loves Indians and so on. And I'll only say to you, what Dinesh D'Souza says in What Makes America So Great, and that is, so he would hear those things, and so he goes, so what Indians, you, well, the Sioux, I mean, we just took them out. So he let the Sioux tell their story, and he let academics in the academic land tell the Sioux story. And then Dinesh D'Souza, in his both his movie and his book, says, well, let's take a look at that a little bit. And so he goes and finds the some Cheyenne, and that's who took it away from the Sioux, took it away from the Cheyenne, and said, so how, Cheyenne, how do you feel about these things that the academics are saying about the Sioux? And they said, they're murders, they're slaughters, they're savages, they're everything, an Indian to an Indian. And all Dinesh D'Souza is trying to say there is, there's always another side of the story. And I'll bet there's a side than even than before the Cheyenne. Then I bet there's a side even before that. You know what I mean? And so it just seems that that's the way history goes. And so just to pop up and make United States evil for what it did to the Indians is not looking at the other side of the story.
There's one other thing that I'm thinking. What happened was... colonists came from largely England, but other countries in Europe as well, to the early colonies, and there was a meeting of civilizations, a clash of civilizations, really. But you had a developed civilization encountering a non-developed situation. They hadn't invented the wheel. They didn't have written language. Okay, I mean, those are fundamental things that have been around for centuries in Western Europe. Do you know of, there have been such clashes of civilizations meeting in various countries in various times in history. Do you know of any country that has handled the problem better?
I honestly, don't know much about that. I was personally okay. Feeling from an Indian lady, an English lady, yeah. I feel like, again, that it was beyond the whole realm.
Okay.
And whether or not the Indians were as mature or smart as the English, yeah, being they invented the wheel, I'm sure the Indians had, yeah, some attributes that the English did not have. So I just was wondering, in defense to my religion and my stance, how I could combat with someone. I don't even combat with anyone, yeah, honestly. If someone talks in a combative way, I don't talk about it.
Chelsea, I don't think we can go into it any further now, but we don't want to be in the position of saying the United States has always done right. It hasn't. There have been some wrong things. Slavery is the greatest one. And in the Indian and settlers conflict, there were no doubt wrong things done too. So I guess I think I'll just leave it at that. Should we? Anything else? Although I don't know if any country has handled it better. So.
Countries that produce and export, them hitting a wall.
Yeah, uh-huh.
Sure. What do they need to do, Barry?
Well, the country previous to now Japan doing that, and now China is doing that, is Argentina. That ism is called mercantilism. Mercantilism is one of the isms that you export more than you import. And what economists would say is it unbalances the economy away from consumption. And so let's take now China, who's been doing this now for about 20 years. They're now a nation that a good part of their GDP doesn't even go to consumption. It goes to trade. It goes to sending wealth over to us. Thank you. Thank you very much. And when an economy gets overbalanced like that, not a consistency, and it hits a wall and finds out, you know what, we don't know which way to go now. We're so trained, our business people and our manufacturing is so trained for exports that we haven't thought about the internal growth of wealth in our economy, and so that's where China finds itself right now, and it's going to absolutely have to figure it out, or if it doesn't, it's going to spin a lot of wheels with all the other problems added to that. But mercantilism just hasn't worked. Argentina, there's an Argentine economist that woke up one day and said, look, trade is bad, let's forget importing, and let's just export. And he not only convinced Argentina to do it, but convinced a lot of South America. Another reason why South America cannot get traction. It hasn't had a good economic system by which to get good traction. That is, a free market, limited government, rule of law, and let everybody do what they do best.
Ken, do we have time for one more?
What should they do instead? They will have to begin to retar. Well, not should they do, they are doing it. China is now saying, look it, we don't think we can get away with paying 60 to 80 cents an hour for all these people working in manufacturing. So in the last 8 or 10 years, China has been raising some of their salaries, and now has they got a manufacturing person's salary up to about $6 to $8 an hour instead of 60 to 80 cents an hour. Perfect, because now you're internally paying people more money, which will start to be generating that consumption, consumption that they so badly need.
So then you're producing goods not just to sell to the United States.
Exactly.
You're producing goods that people in the country will buy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For the benefit of the country. Okay.
Huh. Thank you.
Okay. Well, I'm just sitting here thinking, Ken, a couple of things. Do you see why we say that Ron Sider is wrong when he says the solution to poverty is for you to give away more? That's totally off the map. I mean, there are so many things that need to be done within poor countries themselves. That's what we're trying to say, economic system, government, and we're going to get the big one that Christians can influence is cultural beliefs. We'll come back to that. Second thing, Ken, I went to the bookstore, which is across the way that down that basement area. They have a whole table full of really good books on economics. Barry's in my book, of course, but two that I'd recommend if you want to wander over there at the break, When Helping Hurts by Colbert and Fickert. It's on great on individual care for the poor, When Helping Hurts. And there it is, When Helping Hurts. And Dead Aid by Moyo. I'm not sure if that's there, but it might be.
Okay, this is there.
Okay, and then Money, Greed, and God by Jay Richards. Really good book.
Great book.
On economic system. Tyranny of Experts, I don't know if that's there. You talk about
it might not be in there, but they really should get this in their library, don't you think, Wayne?
Yes.
Yeah. Easterly just simply says that paternalism doesn't work.
Ah.
You can try paternalism till you're blue in the face. And so the tyranny of the experts is that's what experts are always doing. Listen up, do you know? And he says you've got to be listening to those people a lot. And so this is a dynamite book, really. I think one of the best. Christianity Today, but World Magazine chose this as their
book
of the year
instead of our book.
No, but our book. Our book wasn't up against this one, thank goodness.
Right.
We were up the year before. We were up in 2013, and I forget which.
Some other book. Yeah, eminently forgettable.
Yeah.
All right. Ken.
All right, well, let's show our appreciation for the session.